Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
People are fear-mongering. They should have been fear-mongering the fact that we were supporting a brutal dictatorship that had hundreds of thousands of political prisoners and thousands of disappeared, like in Latin America, where people disappeared into the security abyss, never to be heard from again.
That's the voice of Canadian journalist John Elmer reporting to us from Bethlehem about the ongoing struggle for Egyptians to liberate themselves from dictatorship. John contextualizes the struggle and draws some connections to what he believes are the roots of this. Stay tuned.
We're very privileged today to have John Elmer. He's a Toronto writer and photojournalist. We reach him in Bethlehem. Welcome to our show, John.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. The world is in a celebratory move. All empires are put on notice. Their number is up. People are rising up. What can we learn from the Tunisian uprising and now the exciting revolution in Egypt?
You can never take anything for granted. You never know. People never saw this coming. There was no kind of structural analysis from the pundits or scholars or talking heads. It appeared to come out of nowhere from probably the most repressive regime and the most influentially repressive regime, at least in the region, linchpin of American and Israeli control of the Middle East, and the sort of prototype of a ruling dictatorship, a military police state with the most savage repressive apparatus against its population, illegal detention, disappearances, a police state where people disappeared from whence they never returned. No word, no trials, you know, not even a modicum of democratic rigor for people's detentions. And seemingly out of nowhere, one of the most authentic revolutionary processes that's taken place in recent memory, arguably in modern history, is taking place really without any leadership, without any structural organization from political parties, from religious figures, and without any financial backing, without any international backing. Just a truly authentic grassroots revolution that is apparently on the way to succeeding. It's really remarkable. It's remarkable all over the region. I think Tunisia was the catalyst, if you will, for that. And I think what happened in Tunisia was also not predicted. 23-year dictatorship in Tunisia was overthrown in really less than a month. And in Egypt, you see a 30-year dictatorship backed by tens of billions of dollars of U.S. security aid is teetering at this point right now. It hasn't been overthrown yet, but it's teetering. It's got the regime on the ropes, at best on the ropes, and probably these are its death spasms. So it's truly remarkable. I mentioned today on TV that the most important university in the country, possibly on earth, is in Tahrir Square in Cairo right now. So it's I think it's something that people should be impressed with, should look to replicate, and should keep people out of the sort of negativity that seems to dominate the political discourse in fallow countries like Canada and the United States.
What's the significance for the region?
Oh, it's massive. I mean, Mubarak regime was the linchpin of the regional project for the Israelis and the Americans. It's hard to even know where to begin. I mean, you've got just the situation in Palestine, where I am. You have an Egyptian land border with Gaza. Mubarak has maintained the siege on the Palestinians, the brutal siege on the Gaza Strip, keeping people on the edge of starvation. It's an Israeli policy, but it's backed by Mubarak as crucially as it is by the Israelis, because there's two borders in Gaza. One is into Israel and one is into Egypt. So you have really an equal amount of onus on the Mubarak regime to maintain the siege. So that could be lifted. You could have a functioning land border with Gaza, which could allow it to both import goods that it needs, but also, more crucially, to export and to get the economy of Gaza back on its feet by exporting its wares and importing the things that are needed to rebuild the country. So that's a significant situation right there. I mean, regionally, you have Egypt in control of the Suez Canal, which is one of the two or three most important shipping corridors on the planet. You could have people's control of the Suez Canal. You could be having the taxation and tariffs of the Suez Canal used for popular benefit in a country of 80 million people with 85% of the population living on less than $2 a day in Egypt. Egypt's poorer than the Gaza Strip, in fact. So you could have significant taxation going from the Suez. You could have popular control over a major shipping route like that, which is a significant democratic improvement. Mubarak is the model for the dictatorships in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Those two dictatorships were felt to be under pressure. There could be significant movements in those two countries as well, which would isolate Israel significantly. The dictatorships are a key pillar of how Israel is able to survive. Massive American security aid and security training to the dictatorships that surround Israel. You could have a land corridor connecting the North African states with the Sinai Peninsula, which would allow militarily a land corridor all the way to the border of Israel. Israel's southern border with the desert is a massive desert border, very difficult to defend, which you'd couple with in the north. You have from Central Asia running through Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. You have a land corridor in the north, so Israel would be militarily trapped on both sides by significant hostile entities, presumably. And that would be a situation that perhaps could shake Israel from its posture of omnipotence and brutality in the region, which could have significant impacts on the way that it deals with its indigenous population internally, with the Palestinians and the West Bank and Gaza externally, and with the region itself, with Lebanon and whatnot externally. So, not even to mention the good example, the terrifying good example that the Americans are so afraid of, that it's possible to overthrow your dictatorship with nothing but concerted grassroots popular uprising. No significant religious element, no significant financial backer abroad, simply a popular uprising that is demanding principled democratic reforms. I mean, that good example, it's very difficult to quantify or to effectively qualify the significance to the world of that example. A group of people seemingly disconnected, without a leader, and without any societal structural support, can overthrow a dictatorship that's been in power really without contestation for 30 years, for a generation and a half. I think the good example, more than any of the military or economic things I listed, is the real impact of this.
It's interesting you mentioned the grassroots movement and organization, the swell of support that just came out of nowhere. In the West, we seem to be obsessed with the idea of leaders leading the way and people following. This totally puts it on its head. What do you feel will be the significance for Western politics in the region and the years of domination over that region in terms of economic and resource access?
I think at this point right now it's difficult to see, because I think the West is so caught off guard, and you can see with the Obama regime and Hillary Clinton's pathetic statements. The European Union statements are pathetic and weeks behind what's going on. Canada is again showing itself to be as retrograde as ever, making the Obama regime look like, you know, a backer of popular struggles. We're so regressive in our posture in Canada. I don't think it's possible to really know what the Western impact will be, because I think what the U.S. wants and what Israel wants in this case was to administer a palace coup to make it so that Mubarak stepped down, but that's the same ruling, you know, pliable ruling dictatorship effectively stayed in place. So that the $1.5 billion in U.S. security aid would continue to the regime, and really it would just be a matter of a couple of months of security meetings to really get back on track to where they were. I think at this point the West is scrambling, and what the impact will be is to be seen. But I think what's most significant is that whatever the West's response is at this point it's completely in the hands of the demonstrators. The entire narrative of the uprising is being controlled by a leaderless movement on the streets that before 2 weeks ago didn't even know each other. And I think that's what's remarkable. And I think when you look at the catalysts, what the catalysts for this regime, for this overthrow have been, I think, you know, when you say it's leaderless and it came out of nowhere, I mean, I think it's important to note that it did come from somewhere. And on the ground in Egypt, many people point to the killing in Alexandria a year and a half ago of Khalid Said, who was beaten to death on the streets by Mubarak security forces in front of everybody. And nobody did anything, and it was really this moment of fear in the dictatorship that allowed this young man to be beaten to death for no reason. I think immediately after that, there was a significant groundswell in Alexandria, which is Egypt's second biggest city. There was a real groundswell of popular demonstrations against the police forces. They were very targeted against the police forces and not against Mubarak and not against the security forces. As sort of a careful step in the early stages. But I think really the beating to death of this one man was really the trigger for something that has been happening. You know, there's been demonstrations in Egypt for years, but they're usually corralled and they're usually only allowed to be about certain topics. So I think there has been precedent, but nothing on this stage. And I think in Tunisia, you saw the spark in Tunisia was, again, one person. It was the unfortunate self-immolation of the one man who was sort of represented the repressive apparatus in Tunisia, when a university graduate who couldn't work and so was selling vegetables on the street to survive, which is sort of a, you know, the archetype of the Tunisian young generation, had his produce destroyed by the security forces. Really what you have is one individual incident that sort of represents the larger whole. That's really been able to spark the groundswell of popular outrage that everybody feels. And I think that's the significant thing that could be taken by people in Canada and the United States, is that although they're individual incidents, what those incidents do is underscore a collective rage that's felt within the wider population, and it gives it an ability to sort of foment something that everybody feels. And I think in Canada we have many of those sort of unifying things that that the state fails to provide for the general population, and disagreements on basic elementary structures within our society that are felt by everybody, but that don't coalesce in the way that we've seen in these two examples. But the possibility is there, and I think, as I say, that's what's the most significant about Egypt and Tunisia. It's the example, and I think more so in Egypt, because I think, unfortunately, in Tunisia, when all eyes got taken off Tunisia and onto Egypt, I think that the restructuring of the dictatorship has effectively happened, and I think the revolution was truncated in Tunisia. And I think people in Egypt have seen that and are refusing to allow things like Mubarak stepping down, Mubarak saying that he wouldn't run in next election, talk about reform, haven't been able to undermine these demonstrations. In fact, yesterday was bigger than any of the other ones. So I think that's what's another positive example of Egypt, is not to quit too soon, but to carry through with the structural changes that need to happen in the societies, and don't allow politicians' rhetoric to take away the energy from these demonstrations.
Last Saturday, worldwide, there were demonstrations in many countries in solidarity with the Egyptian people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way the media has been reported, at least in Canada, has been a sort of mixed feelings of, yes, we're excited for people getting rid of a dictator. On the other hand, be careful, the Muslim Brotherhood might be coming in. What do you make of this fear mongering that, you know, tends to almost justify or legitimize, you know, in some areas you may need a dictator to run things?
Well, let me just say one thing. Being based in the Middle East and having been out of Canada for a significant amount of time, I can tell you that I don't consume Canadian news media, and I think that one of the great additions to my life since moving over here has been to skip completely the pathetic Canadian mainstream media. The Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the CBC itself is just terrible on this region. I mean, Margaret Evans is reporting from Egypt is shockingly ill-informed. Adrian Arsenault is reporting from the West Bank. I get emails into my account about this reporting regularly. Yesterday, Adrian Arsenault for the CBC reported from Palestine and said that Palestinians were upset that they were losing an ally in Mubarak, which is just really, it's gobsmackingly ill-informed for a professional journalist. I mean, it's ill-informed for a high school history student. So if people, really, I think a colleague of mine, Justin Potter, who's based out of Toronto, writes for Z Magazine and VNet, wrote an essay during the Gaza War where he said, just turn it off. And I think there was used to be this, you know, Trotskyist argument that it was necessary to read all of the media so that you knew what your enemies, if you will, were saying. But his argument was simply just turn it off. We have better sources in this day and age. We have access in every single home in Canada to international media. We have access to the internet, which allows us to select the most important sources around the world, and there's just no more compelling reason anymore to pick up the Globe and Mail, which isn't even a newspaper anymore. It's basically a website on newsprint now. There's not substantive articles. The journalists are ill-informed with no histories within the region themselves. The editors have an easily predictable bias against the things that people want to consume and want to understand. And there's just really no good reason anymore in 2011 to be consuming these things simply because they're printed and on the shelf at your corner store or that they'll be delivered to your house. So I don't really see any reason to consume it, and I haven't recently in my time abroad, and I'm more informed than I ever have been at any time in my life. And so I would recommend people to really just do that, to step beyond that narrative, because you can see more than anything in Egypt how ill-informed the reporting is. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has been allowed to exist, quasi-exist through the state. It's tolerated. It's illegal, but it's tolerated. Its structural and organizational capacity has not been imprisoned and cracked down upon. It's really its rank and file that's put in prison. And so they've been allowed to sort of exist outside the framework. And so they have the most established political framework within the country oppositionally. They're a conservative religious organization. They don't represent what is the most important element of this revolution, and that is the young generation. The young and upcoming generation that sees that their leadership doesn't have anything in common with them. And nothing could typify that more than the religious conservatism of the Muslim Brotherhood. So yes, they're a part of the fabric of Egypt. They're a part of the fabric in the West Bank as well, and in Gaza as well with Hamas. But they don't represent the youth. They don't represent this new generation and this important narrative of up-and-coming political discourse that needs to be reckoned with by the older generations. To fear the Muslim Brotherhood co-opting this revolution is as ill-informed as believing that Egyptians need a dictatorship to rule over them. And I don't think that there's anybody in Tahrir Square who is going to stop protesting in the street because the Muslim Brotherhood says that we're going to take over this revolution. It's simply not going to happen, and anybody saying that is ill-informed about the most important political trend that's taking root within the Arab world and within the wider world itself. But I think at this point right now, the Arab world is the vanguard of both American empire, Western empire, and also at this point it's showing itself to be the vanguard of the resistance to that. And I think the Muslim Brotherhood represents the same percentage within any society that religious conservatives represent. And I'm sure in Canada, religious conservatives represent 15 or 20% of the population at most. That's about what it is in Palestine, and that's probably what it is in Egypt as well. And what you're talking about is saying that the 15% of the population of an elderly, you know, an older generation, sort of throwback, regressive political structure is going to co-opt the 85% of the population that has nothing in common with it. And I think people have nothing to worry about the Muslim Brotherhood co-opting this revolution. And if they did, and if they do, it's only going to be with the consent and assent of the populations itself, as is what happened in Palestine when Hamas was able to appeal to the younger generation structurally as an alternative to the corruption of the Western-backed Palestinian Authority, Canadian-backed Palestinian Authority. And the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas was able to respond to the younger generation in a way to get itself elected. And if that were to happen in Egypt, then that's a perfectly legitimate trend. No signs are pointing to that, but there's nothing to be worried about in fear-mongering about who's going to take over. I mean, when people are fear-mongering, they should have been fear-mongering the fact that we were supporting a brutal dictatorship that had hundreds of thousands of political prisoners and thousands of disappeared, like in Latin America, where people disappeared into the security abyss, never to be heard from again.
In the interim, people are facing serious issues with food shortages, and you know, as any regime that's about to collapse, I'm reminded of the story of Venezuela when Hugo Chavez was returned to power. The immediate reaction was to limit access to goods and, you know, foods and essentials that people need to demoralize the population. How would you describe the ambience or the spirit on the streets?
Well, I mean, you can see it in the square itself. I mean, people, you can see it just even watching, the television cameras. You can see when people were battling paid thugs who were attacking the demonstrations, and people were fighting back for their territory with stones. You could see when you watched them, they'd throw stones, they'd come back, and someone would run up and pass them a bottle of water or a pita sandwich as they were coming back to the, you know, to get more stones. You can see that kind of ethic that's happening within the square. People are feeding themselves. People set up a field hospital. You know, that kind of the revolutionary sentiment is taking care of everybody. I don't think there's any illusions within Egyptian society that there's going to be some difficult periods of transition. And I think that a lot of people that have benefited from the dictatorship see their benefit in trying to undermine the revolution, and will do that through many different aspects, including limiting food distribution and whatnot. And I don't think that there's any illusions about the fact that there's going to be some difficult times ahead before the country is able to right itself. But when it does right itself, it has the possibility to use its national capacities for popular benefit instead of for the benefit of an elite regime that sends their money to Swiss bank accounts. And I think that the Egyptian people have shown the determination and the capacity to withstand the temporary setbacks in favor of a new dawn, which I think is something that the rest of the world should be looking at as inspiration. And I think that that's the most valuable thing coming out of Tahrir Square, is that there's nothing particularly Egyptian about what is going on. It's an opportunity for the rest of the world to view the type of popular example that Egypt is showing and institute it within their own corrupt regimes.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is John Elmer. He's a Canadian photojournalist who has lived in and reported from Palestine for more than a decade. He is currently living in Bethlehem. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
África, Brasil, diretamente do mundo frio, Canadá, é nóis que tá. Nomad de Marte, Universal Home, do Haiti ao Canadá, do Brasil ao Iraque, vai segurando.
You hear me say, yo, burn them, cause them a burn you too. Ay, run them, cause them a try to run you, try and turn you fool on. Leave you for dead when they fill up you head with them dibby dibby talk and them dibby dibby walk. Watch how you go on, you know no way you did them. Sin you down and pray while them stand up and take for your food, for your spirit, pan your back house and make keep your cool, make them feel it, yo. Dig for them cool and build back for your quarter. Eat for them food, stay on track, drink your water. It no make no sense, you running after one man's dream is the next man's disaster. Dash way in my hands if I can't feel fun. You live strong and galang about your business. Seamless, no move, no growth. Soon you guy live by your own shine. And not no, give me line. Fit they give your mind, pan them, giddy grind. Why you losing time? And feel your pick me losing fit me, case I make God. They moving circles, we moving forward.
We have this head on. Dripping like cold.
So we can unite like a pole.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that many shit fall.
No way, no way.
We moving forward.
Just like a bird.
We crashing them walls.
Like the first
fall. Lift your spirit and fall.
So we can all shine.
Cause we shed his head long.
Man, pas mes lacets, Batman, Timantine, Paladin. Nomadic, c'est Selvan, pas Jamvan à la prenne. C'est le singe, Copyman. Sort de là, on en cas. Combien de fois notre rack a des espoirs? Sans blague, on follow la méricain, on courait qu'un, on promet qu'un. Polémique, polémique, comment qu'un. Crée ton propre chemin, décoller n'en plein. Défendre croise aux anticorps ou mon cher ou trop malin. Nomadic, Africa, on voyage en bus de bus. Customs office, get the best of us, forget the bus, bus it. On avance sous les sangs, boulet dans la foule et laisse la vibe couler. Oublie ceux qui jouent les fous, la laisse le poison les sous les roulés sur l'or, c'est pas l'objectif. Casse la boîte, sort dehors, hors subjectif, live sélectif. Connect the right projects, got a flea market full of it. Lift every rock, toute une vérité à soulever. Recto sin escala, quien nos para, palante sin pena. Sin edición, crudo, no tengas miedo, prueba. Levanta el orgullo, do you, sois toi-même, être humain libre. Je vais où le vent m'amène.
Je fonctionne, cela me fonctionne.
Bust the move and it's work, serve words with nerve.
No way that the crowd can sit down.
We have this hand on.
So we can see through the eyes.
Time gripping like gold.
So we can unite like a pole.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that many shit fall.
No way, no way.
We moving forward.
Just like a bird.
We crashing them walls.
Like the bird.
Lift your spirit and draw.
So we can all shine.
Cause we shed the same blood.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
África pra trabalhar essa lama lá. Basta acreditar que você pode chegar lá. Atravessando geleiras, vencendo os desertos, quebrando barreiras, transcendendo os dialetos. Já blessing, relaxa aliciai, a jazambiorai. Rastafari, ensinamento haitiano. É o canto patuá, oxalá, vou lá. Porque eu bata lá, mistura bata cubano com chuva de Trinidad. É nós que dá, o povo daqui, o povo que vem de lá. Africano, guerreiro soldier, pra hoje pra Iemanjá, no toque de Jeja.
We use the present day moment to recreate the past. All facts, we autograph that on wax and speed the brass. You slow the cash, now why try like wireless Wi-Fi? We connect back to back just like Echo. Pro bono de aquí hasta el sol del Rio. Nous campé con les sous-eau, tant qu'ou presse grillon. Simon le retracé, vérité, nous qu'elle nassant. Tout ma change, j'ai masqué, un marché, vous ne rivez.
We have his head on. I'm gripping like gold.
So we can unite like a pole.
All them wicked shall fall.
Yeah, bad man fall.
It's not that man you should call.
No way, no way.
We moving forward.
Just like a bird.
We crashing them walls.
Like the bird.
Lift your spirit and draw.
So we can all shine.
Cause we share the same blood.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
We are the pun. Now, by the watch, we
That was the incredible lyrics of Nomadic Massive and their melody, Moving Forward. For more information on their music, go to myspace.nomadicmassive.org.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the US. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.